Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo, Susan Shand, and Steve Ember. But first, this report from Ann Ball.
The College Board said that more than 2.2 million students in the class of 2019 took the College Entrance Test, SAT. That is the largest group ever, and an increase of 4% from the previous year. The average score, however, dropped a little, from 1068 to 1059. The SAT is a test many American colleges require as part of the admissions process. It is a multiple-choice test, which means students must decide which answer is the best from several provided for each question. Higher scores can make the difference between being admitted into the top colleges and universities and how much financial aid a student may receive. Research shows that students who have greater access to college entrance exams, like the SAT and ACT, are more likely to apply to college. This is particularly true for low-income students. The College Board also said nearly a million students of the 2019 class took the SAT on a school day. The SAT school day program makes it easier for low-income, minority students, and students from families with no history of college attendance to take the SAT. Traditionally, students have to register and pay for the tests, then travel to testing centers on a weekend to take them. For people without the resources of a computer, credit card, or car, it can be difficult. Some states now give college entrance exams, like the ACT and SAT, for free on a school day during school hours. Cindy Schmeiser is a senior advisor to the College Board. She said, SAT school day gives students nationwide increased access to higher education. The program, she added, helps students who would not or could not take the test on a weekend. The College Board also encouraged students to take the test earlier. Schmeiser said, by promoting early testing, practice on Khan Academy, and SAT retakes at no charge for lower-income students, we hope to help more students achieve their educational and career goals. Inside Higher Ed says test scores among minority groups have been lower for many years. In 2019, more African American and Latino students failed to meet the SAT test results for college readiness than the year before. Fair Test, the National Center for Fair and Open Testing, studied the new SAT results. It says the SAT score gaps or differences between different groups grew larger for the high school class of 2019. Robert Schaefer is Fair Test's public education director. He criticized the SAT test in an email to VOA. Whether broken down by test takers' race, parental education, or household income, he wrote, average SAT scores of students from historically disenfranchised groups fell further behind their classmates from more privileged families. Schaefer said, the SAT remains a more accurate measure of a test taker's family background than a student's ability to do college-level work. He said, it is no wonder nearly 40% of all four-year colleges and universities in the country are now test optional. He said, they recognize that these exam requirements undermine diversity without improving educational quality. I'm Ann Ball.
Hi there, and welcome to this week's Words and Their Stories. On today's show, we will talk about an idiom of warning. And it is not very easy to say. Loose lips sink ships. This idiom began during World War II as a slogan used by the United States Office of War Information. It was part of a propaganda campaign. So the slogan, loose lips sink ships, was printed on posters and hung in many public places, such as schools and churches. This wartime expression warned people in the military, as well as ordinary citizens, to watch what they say. Unguarded talk may give useful information to the enemy. Part of the propaganda campaign warned that simply revealing the location of a loved one on a ship could be dangerous. That information could be passed on to the enemy or to a spy. The posters show in detail a ship being attacked and soldiers being killed. This idiom still may not make sense to you, so let's break it down. Something loose moves easily. So loose lips move freely and release a lot of words, most likely in a careless way. If you speak carelessly, that's the loose lips part, about private or sensitive information, someone could hear and use it to damage or ruin something important. A sinking ship is pretty bad. The message? Be careful when you speak. Watch what you say. Beware of spies. And during war, you never know who is a spy. That is the nature of spying. One of the most famous, or maybe I should say infamous, spies in history was the Dutch dancer Mata Hari. Well, Mata Hari was the name she used when she performed as a dancer in Paris in the early 1900s. The online Encyclopedia Britannica explains that Mata Hari was romantically linked to a number of men. Many of them were military officers around the time of World War I. Both Germany and France must have believed some of those officers would have loose lips around this beautiful woman, because the two countries sought to get secret information from her. But when French officials suspected she was spying for Germany, they arrested her. She was tried and found guilty of supplying Germany with information. She was shot by firing squad on October 15th, 1917. It is unlikely that Mata Hari was responsible for sinking any ships. and she may not have been a spy. Some documents reportedly prove her innocence, although her relatives may find that evidence to be cold comfort. After all, her reputation remains damaged. We still use the name Mata Hari to describe a devious woman who uses her sexual appeal to get men to spill their secrets. Now let's go back to loose lips sinking ships. Keep in mind that you do not have to be in the middle of a war to use that idiom. For example, let's say you are working on a project at work with a small team of people. Until you are ready to launch the secret product, it is best that no one else knows. So you can warn your teammates that loose lips sink ships. If they want the project to be successful, they should keep the details to themselves. And that's the end of this Words in Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo. Be careful what you
say. At an international conference in Uzbekistan, a government official suddenly collapsed onto the floor. Other government workers casually carried the man away. Just a few minutes earlier, the man was seen moving from one side of the room to the other, making sure even the smallest details of the conference were just right. The Reuters news agency reports that what happened to him was not an unusual event. The Central Asian nation is slowly opening its economy to other areas. To get the nation ready, some government workers have been working 15-hour days, 7 days a week, for more than 3 years. Foreign businessmen who go to Uzbekistan face an unusual problem: making sure the officials they are meeting stay awake. "He fell asleep twice during an afternoon meeting," said one Western businessman after meeting a mid-level Uzbek official. Uzbekistan, once part of the Soviet Union, is home to 33 million people. Government workers there have a tradition of not leaving the office before their boss does. But since the death of Uzbek President Islam Karimov in 2016, working all day long, every day, has become a way of life. His replacement, Shavkat Mirziyoyev, says he wants the country to move forward. He has asked government workers to be more responsible to the needs of Uzbekistan's citizens. When President Mirziyoyev came to power, he declared an emergency for government workers and said that officials would not rest until we please the people, said one Uzbek official. He spoke to Reuters on the condition of anonymity for fear of openly criticizing the system. "The president usually works long hours, so everyone below him feels they must do the same. Perhaps sensing that his country's workers are tired, the president last month ordered officials to leave their offices at 5 in the afternoon on Saturdays and spend Sundays with their families. But in reality, nothing has changed," said the same Uzbek official. I'm Susan Shand.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. Last time, we talked about the presidential election of 1804. Thomas Jefferson, the nation's third president, was easily re-elected. Jefferson was head of the Democratic Republican Party, known today as the Democratic Party. Thomas Jefferson had a very good record during his first term as president. He ended many taxes. He paid government debts. And he gained possession of the huge Louisiana Territory from France without going to war. His political opponents were the Federalists. The Federalists were sure Jefferson would win the election of 1804. Still, they were surprised by the strength of his victory. Jefferson won 162 electoral votes. His Federalist opponent won just 14. In the early 1800s, Britain and France were at war with each other. The United States remained neutral. Historian Andrew O'Shaughnessy says President Jefferson did not want to become involved in a war.
He was sufficiently pro-French that he didn't want to ally with the British, but not so pro-French that he wanted a war with the British.
Jefferson also believed getting involved in a European war would destroy all the progress he had made at home. His economic policies had helped to pay much of America's national debt, and he was able to reduce taxes. But staying neutral was not easy. The United States was having trouble with Britain. For many years, Britain had been taking men by force to serve in its navy. Britain claimed the right to seize any British citizen anywhere. The custom was called impressment. Conditions in the Royal Navy were not good at that time, and many sailors deserted. Some went to work on American ships. The American ships were stopped and searched in British waters. Anyone born in Britain was seized. Historian Andrew O'Shaughnessy says sometimes American citizens were also taken.
There was also still something of an imperial attitude in Britain towards America. You know, they were still insisting that some American citizens had been born British. It was often difficult for them to be able to distinguish between their own subjects and Americans.
Several thousand sailors were taken off American ships during the early 1800s. In 1807, an incident made relations between Britain and America even more tense. Britain believed that four of its sailors had deserted and fled to an American ship called the Chesapeake. The United States said the men were American citizens who had been forced to serve in the British Navy. The United States refused to return them. When the Chesapeake sailed out of American waters, the British ship Leopard tried to stop and search it. The American captain would not stop. First, the British ship fired two warning shots. Then it fired all its guns directly at the Chesapeake. The American ship could do little to defend itself. The captain surrendered. News of the British attack spread quickly. President Jefferson ordered all British Navy ships in American waters to leave at once. He told people not to aid the British. He said any person, American or British, who disobeyed his orders would be arrested. In response, the British government announced a new rule. It said any American ship sailing to Europe must stop first in Britain to get permission. Ships violating the rule would be seized. relations between the two countries were reaching the breaking point. Impressment was just one of the major problems the United States was having with Britain in the early 1800s. Another problem was trade. Britain wanted to stop the United States from trading with France and its colonies. British warships blocked the port of New York all through 1805. No American ship could leave without being searched. Any ship found to be carrying goods for France was taken north to Halifax, Nova Scotia. There, a British court had the power to seize the goods and force the ship's owners to pay a large fine. In the closing days of 1807, President Thomas Jefferson signed a bill banning all trade with Europe. No ships could enter or leave the United States. Jefferson did not believe that trade embargoes were the best way to settle America's problems with other nations, but at the time, he thought an embargo was the only way to deal with Britain and France short of war, and he did not want war. Jefferson later explained why he thought the embargo was the best choice of action. He said, if American ships had sailed out of American waters, they would have been seized by Britain or France. That would have forced the United States into war. Jefferson said it was far better to stop all contact with these nations until they returned to some sense of justice. Jefferson acted to protect American traders, ship owners, and sailors. Yet those were the people who protested the loudest against the ban. They were willing to take the chance of having Britain or France seize their ships and goods. They could not make any money without trade. The situation quickly turned into a political battle between the Jeffersonian Republicans and the opposition Federalists. Federalist newspapers attacked Jefferson. They called him a tool of France and its leader. They charged that Jefferson supported the trade ban to help Napoleon Bonaparte. One Federalist senator wrote a pamphlet against the embargo. He urged Northeastern states to refuse to enforce it. Then he went even further. He met secretly with a British official who was sent to Washington to discuss the situation. He told the British official that Jefferson would be forced out of office because of the embargo. Jefferson simply wished to give the trade embargo a fair chance. He considered the embargo less evil than war. But after a time, he thought, this will not be so. If the war should continue in Europe, and if Britain and France continue to act against us, then it would be for Congress to say if war would not be better than the embargo. Jefferson hoped that the loss of American trade would force Britain and France to change their policies toward the United States. And he hoped the change would come quickly. He knew that the American people would not accept a long ban on trade. A British traveler visiting New York City described what the embargo had done. The port is full of ships, but all of them are closed. Only a few sailors can be seen. Many of the counting houses are closed. The coffee houses are almost empty. The streets near the water are almost deserted.
grass has begun to grow upon the docks. America's northern industrial states felt the loss of trade most deeply. But the agricultural South also was affected. Rich southern farmers and planters suddenly found themselves poor. Tobacco was one of their major crops, and Britain bought more American tobacco than any other country. Because of the embargo, the price of tobacco fell so low that it had almost no value. The price of wheat fell from $2 a bushel to 7 cents a bushel. Good farmland dropped in value until it was worth almost nothing. Opposition to the embargo was growing. The opposition was strongest in the Northeast. Ship owners and traders believed that the embargo was wrong. They continued to export goods secretly. Some traders began sending goods over land to Canada. From there, the goods were sent on to Britain. Congress passed a law against this kind of trade, but the shipments did not stop. Too many people were willing to violate the law for the large amounts of money they could make by trading secretly with Britain. By August 1808, Treasury Secretary Albert Gallatin had lost all hope that the embargo would be successful. Gallatin told President Jefferson that the embargo was defeated by open violations. Another of Jefferson's supporters gave the president some advice. If the embargo could be enforced, and if the people would accept it, then I am sure it would be the wisest course. But if it cannot be enforced completely, and if the people will not accept it, then it will not serve its purpose and should not be continued. Jefferson, however, was not ready to give up his plan. In his last State of the Union message to Congress, he painted a bright picture of the nation. He reported that American industry was making progress. Many goods that had been imported before the embargo were now being made at home. He said almost all of the national debt had been paid, and he said more than 100 gunboats had been built, enough, he declared, to defend the country. Jefferson said nothing about opposition to the embargo, nor did he talk about the serious economic problems caused by it. He said only that Britain and France still refused to honor American neutrality, and so the embargo must continue. The rest of the nation was not so sure. Congress began debating a number of proposals to either lift or amend the embargo. In the first months of 1809, Congress finally approved a bill. The bill lifted the ban on trade with all European countries except Britain and France. Jefferson had hoped to continue the embargo a little longer and with more powers to enforce it. He was not satisfied with the final bill, but he signed it anyway on March 1st. 3 days later, the 15-month-old embargo was dead, and the United States had a new president.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.